following is a previously broadcast program.
There are some heavy topics that come up in this episode, including suicide.
We are what you call a party band, so we do everything from standards to country to 50s and 60s rock and roll, R&B, reggae, everything. I love R&B.
As a singer in a party band, Sterling Howell knows a lot about partying. Being the life of the party is basically his job. He sings for the cruise line Princess Cruises. So, Sterling knows when a party is going well.
It's like if you go to the club, there's a band performing, you could drink how much you want, and you could just party, you know?
And he knows when the party's falling apart.
You go to the club and then you are confined to one square meter. Then they tell you, okay, you could only have one drink and you have to stay here, social distancing, no groups.
He describes his last cruise as that second kind of party.
It's a lot of change that a lot of people were not accustomed to. And I think a lot of people couldn't deal with it. Cruising, you get to travel the world, do what you love, getting paid to do it. But I don't think the world itself was prepared for something like COVID-19.
I'm Malika Bilal, and this is The Take. When coronavirus hit the cruise industry, the party stopped. After a few days, even weeks in some cases, the passengers were allowed to disembark. But a lot of the crews were still there, and some of them are still on board. In the middle of May, there were 100,000 crew members at sea, trying to get home. Sterling Howell was one of them.
When the passengers got off, the way things were going, we thought everyone was just taking the right precautions to make sure that no one gets sick, and then things will get back running after a couple of weeks. That's what we thought, but I guess everyone thought wrong. So they got all the passengers off the cruise ships, and the ship basically just went just off the coast of Bahamas, trying to distance ourselves from land to protect us from getting the virus.
At first, there were worries about the virus being on board, but on his ship, no one, not the passengers or the crew, contracted it. Still, he was under quarantine and isolated in his room for 4 weeks in all.
You were just in that room. You had your balcony. You could have looked outside, but you were just in that room. After the quarantine process, they raised it a little bit so we could have gotten out, but all the facilities wasn't open. The medical staff, they were doing a great job because we were basically doing temperature checks every single day. Every single day at morning and evening.
Sterling says it wasn't until late March that he heard talk about repatriating crews. Repatriating is just a fancy way of saying getting people like Sterling back home, to his family, to where he wanted to be.
So all the Europeans, they put them on one ship. The Filipinos, the people from South Africa, the people from India, they put them on one ship. The Americans and the Canadians, they put them on one ship.
Sterling is from the island nation of Trinidad and Tobago. So he got on the ship for the Caribbean Princess.
They sent all the Caribbean and South Americans on one ship. So that's when the repatriation started.
In theory, he was one step closer to home. But it wasn't that easy. And the reason it wasn't easy was because of an order by the Centers for Disease Control in the United States.
As soon as CDC put in the no sail order is the first time that people overlooked this situation.
Krista Thomas has not been overlooking this situation. She's a former guest services director for Norwegian Cruises. After many years at sea, she settled down near the mountains in Vancouver, Canada, to work in the hotel industry there. But when she heard about COVID-19 on the cruise ships, she just kept thinking about her old friends.
there's a connection that I think only crew members understand. When you make a friend on board a ship, they're your friend for life, and no matter how far away they are. And so in speaking with them on a regular basis, of course, I was asking how they were doing.
And her plan to reach out to a few friends grew into a virtual North Star for these crew members.
I started a crew page on Facebook just as a place for them to connect until they got home. But it quickly grew into more of a help desk, really. And that's when crew started reaching out to me a lot, is after the launch of the page.
Using the strength of her home internet connection, she's been trying to get crew members to their homes one by one. And the CDC's no sail order has been one of the biggest obstacles.
The CDC issuing a no sail order in mid-March.
Remember that CDC's no sail order is until July 24th. And
the CDC issued a no sail order mandating that crew members can only leave the ship if they are transported by charter aircraft or private vehicles, no rental cars or taxis, and no commercial flights.
Can you tell me what a no sail order is?
CDC put in a ruling that ships could not operate in U.S. waters or anywhere that the United States has jurisdiction. But they also put incredibly strict restrictions on the cruise lines, where in order for crew to disembark and to go home, if they were coming from a cruise ship, they would not be allowed to use any commercial transportation.
No commercial flights for fear of infecting people. No public transportation.
And then they couldn't stay overnight in hotels. The layover could not exceed 8 hours anywhere.
And the onus falls to the cruise ship companies to make sure this is done.
The cruise lines had to sign a document, you know, agreeing that they had complied with all of this by the CEO and the chief medical officer. And it had criminal sanctions attached to it that should the crew member end up taking any type of public transportation or being ill along the way, that they would be responsible for all of the medical costs and could be held liable with prison time and a fine. And this is when we saw the cruise lines become reluctant to make these plans for their crew members to go home.
So the cruise lines were hesitating, and the crews on board were starting to worry.
It was the first time that the crew, I think, began to have a sense of fear about when they would get home.
We just basically tried to get home. The CDC was probably just being too demanding.
The cruise ship companies were struggling with these new rules to get people like Sterling home. But it wasn't just the cruise lines.
The problem we had was that when everyone was going home, our country wasn't taking us.
Trinidad wouldn't accept Sterling or the hundreds of other Trinidadian crew members aboard these ships. He was stuck. They were all stuck, confined to their rooms with a lot of time and nothing to do.
There's no one for me to perform for. So people like us had our contracts ended. It was a lot of mental things going through your mind. I'm not getting paid. Well, I'm going to take care of my family. When is the country going to bring me home? The other countries are bringing home their people. Why is our country not bringing home my people? In the middle of this crisis, I think I should be home with my family.
Sterling has two kids. His mom is at home. So is his fiance. And when he tells the story, he admits he was lucky in a lot of ways. His church leader was calling him with motivational words. Other friends sent regular messages.
I had a couple of people in the family who were concerned and really aware of what was going on, so they were reaching out to make sure that everything was all right.
But this feeling, his country had abandoned him, it was persistent.
You shouldn't leave anyone behind. And that's the feeling that we were having, that we were getting left behind.
At the same time, in Vancouver, Krista was getting a lot of messages from people like Sterling, who were also feeling left behind.
The desperation is really hard to hear when you have people saying, please help us.
I've read a few of them because you've shared them with our team. And they are harrowing and heartbreaking. Can you read out a few that you think the world should know about?
The captain makes announcements every day that we cannot leave the cabin, otherwise it will be considered a violation. They keep us like prisoners without salary. We're paying for water and drinks, and the prices on board have increased. I try to use the internet when everyone is sleeping so I can get a hold of my family. I've started to smoke 3 times a day and drinking as much as possible. I know it's not good for my health, but there's nothing else to do. I asked my doctor to give me pills. Being very honest right now, I would like to just take some pills and a bottle of wine, sleep for a few weeks, and wake up when this is all over, but I'm afraid I won't wake up. I wake up sweating, shaking, and want medicine to end all of this. 3 people have died this week. 1 crew member did commit suicide. I just wanted to make you aware that life is hell here in isolation. We are all desperate. This has been a never-ending nightmare.
It's hard to say anything after that. But we should say that at this point, there have been class action lawsuits filed against a number of cruise lines. Celebrity Cruises, Royal Caribbean, Princess Cruises. Carnival Cruise Line has upwards of 20 lawsuits pending, and the U.S. Congress is investigating. But Cruise Lines International Association, they represent the cruise industry, they've said the cruise lines, quote, continue to work through diplomatic channels to ensure the safe return home of our crew members, end quote. That's from a statement they gave to the press. They also say they've repatriated thousands so far.
You know, in the beginning, I think, and maybe in time, we're still going to hear things come out about what the cruise lines could have done better or sooner. I'm sure that cost factors into some of their decisions, but I see them paying for charter flights and making these bookings and flight tickets and itineraries being sent to me by photographs and then crew members getting to the airport and finding out that their country has canceled the charter and said it can't come in. These are human lives that we're talking about, and countries need to repatriate their own citizens.
Trinidad's national security minister has said they are trying to keep the disease from spreading and avoid overwhelming the healthcare system there.
Their re-entry will be worked out in a schedule that our public health system can accommodate.
As for Sterling, through willpower, charm, and the magic of the media, he did manage to make it home in the end.
I did a couple of live videos. I called a couple of radio stations, TV stations. We just started protesting. And the people of the country decided that enough is enough. You know, you need to bring home the people. The voice of the people is the voice of God. So the voice of the people, they started crying out. They can't leave our people out there. And then I think the government decided to change their heart and decided to bring us home.
Well, almost home. Sterling is in Trinidad, but he's still in quarantine. As of Monday, June 1st, he has a little less than a week left, and he can't wait to see his family again. But a lot of crew members haven't been so fortunate. Sterling ruefully remembers leaving them behind.
When I left Caribbean, there was people from Nicaragua, people from Guyana. The Mexicans were still there. The people from Panama were still there. There were a couple of people from Venezuela. So I think it's a very depressing feeling to have as a crew member, seeing other countries taking home their crew members, and your country is just not trying to help.
Krista's across many of those cases.
One of the ships in Germany, they need to get home to Russia, but Russia has also closed their borders. 21 to 24 ships in the Manila Bay in Philippines, they were approved to come there and to disembark crew members. And in one sense, I think that the industry is incredibly grateful that the Philippines took them in and allowed this. But they've been there well over a month now. Maybe because I'm from Canada, I've had more success here. We were able to bring home a group of Canadians quite quickly. It's much harder for me to actually get in touch with someone from another country.
Krista's been trying to make contact with government officials literally around the world.
I have crew members who have been reaching out to me from Mauritius, and we have tried to contact their embassy, tried even reaching out to their own prime minister. Of course, I'm not getting an answer. And they actually themselves have hired a lawyer at home who has gone to the Supreme Court to try and dispute the decision not to allow them to come home. Unfortunately, that was rejected.
And that depression Sterling was talking about the crew members feeling, Krista says it's real.
We have tried to enlist the help of psychologists that are willing to volunteer. It's difficult because they can only practice in their own country.
So if a crew member is Venezuelan, a Mexican psychologist isn't legally able to help.
Depending on where the crew members come from, we might have a resource for them and we might not. There is a helpline on most of the cruise ships, but some of the crew members are still sharing cabins and they don't want to pick up the phone in front of a roommate and call a helpline.
Sometimes the help they get comes from Krista herself. She just ends up being the one that answers the phone.
Myself and my other admins have also just done a suicide intervention course online so that if we get anything urgent, we can at least try and use those skills to hold them over until we can get help for them.
There have been a handful of crew member deaths now. At least one employee jumped overboard.
The first suicide didn't even make the papers. It was April 29th, I think. And then the first one that we really heard about that got more attention was the crew member from Poland. I think that was either late April or early May that had gone overboard. And unfortunately, there's been five more that we know of since then. And two failed attempts, which I don't think have made headlines either.
We feel suffocated here.
Dr. Sami is from Mauritius, a small island nation in the Indian Ocean, just east of Madagascar. And when we reached him, he was still floating on board close to 2,000 miles, 3,000 kilometers away from home.
I'm currently on South African waters. Been at sea since the 20th of March. I guess it's been around 9 weeks.
The situation in Mauritius is complicated. His country keeps saying they will bring the Mauritian crew members home, but they haven't brought them home yet.
For us Mauritians, they have a chartered flight ready, but the Mauritian government is not authorizing landing, which is really sad for almost 2,000 Mauritian seafarers worldwide who are not able to return home.
He does medical procedures when the passengers are on board. He still likes the work when things go well, but without passengers, he's not getting paid. And now he fears retaliation from the cruise line for talking to the press. Dr. Sami is a pseudonym. At his request, we've agreed not to use his real name.
Being far from our family during this period and not being able to support them financially is just heartbreaking and builds up a lot of stress. This kind of situation leads to severe depression, which does bring suicidal tendencies.
By now, many on board know there are likely crew members who have taken their own lives.
My sympathy to all the families who lost their loved ones. I have friends going through depression on board. Not everyone is able to cope with their stress.
Dr. Sami is doing okay for now, but he knows others who are really suffering.
I know a friend who lost a family member. The company organized his flights to fly home, but the Mauritian government refused the request.
His friend goes by the name Albert.
My name is Goshyawan Lakshmi Pawasat. Nickname is Albert.
It's not always easy to get in touch with crew members. The ships are constantly in motion and the conditions are unpredictable. But Albert really wanted to get his story out and he managed to get in touch.
Tuesday at about 3:30 South African time, I get a message from my daughter. My daughter recalled me and tell me that my brother get a heart attack and he passed away. So I go to the HR and tell them about the situation. Then the head office tell me that they are doing everything to repatriate me to Mauritius, but the government has not allowed us to enter in our country.
Albert is still thousands of kilometers from home, left thinking about how he wasn't able to see his brother before he started this cruise in January. He keeps going over it in his head.
I am very stressed and depressed. I wish I could have met him before he died. I could have saved him, and now he died.
Close to 2,000 Mauritians are still at sea. And the foreign minister recently got on television saying this.
We all know, we understand our citizens are in pain, in distress, and they want to come back home. But we need to do this in an organized way. We can't dock a ship just like that and have it disembark in Mauritius or have an aircraft land in Mauritius.
Some of the Mauritians we spoke to are still isolated in one room. When you have nothing but hope, it's hard to give that up.
Now, while I'm talking to you just now, I'm passing through Mauritius now, like 100 kilometers from the coast.
One more Mauritian crew member, Gan is his nickname, had his maritime mapping app out while he was on the phone. He was watching the ship he was on slowly trace the Mauritian coast. And for a minute, he let himself daydream that things were different. He was hoping his country would reconsider and imagined himself sailing into the Mauritian port. He imagined himself going home. 24 hours later, Gan sent us this message on his phone.
Today, 26th of May, 8 p.m., my position is already around 1,000 kilometers away from the northeast of Mauritius.
He had gone from 100 kilometers to 1,000 kilometers from home. Gan was getting farther away.
A long way from home now.
Instead of docking at home, the ship headed to Colombo, Sri Lanka. The promise was they would be able to fly to Mauritius from there. But so many other promises had already been broken. Even so, he and the other Mauritians and the thousands of crew members still at sea are hoping their countries will call them home. And that's The Take. If you are struggling with mental health issues, there are suicide crisis lines available in many countries around the world. We'll have a link to some of them up on our website, podcast.aljazeera.com/thetake. This episode was produced by Amy Walters, with help from Dina Kispe, along with Priyanka Tilve, Nay Alvarez, Alexandra Locke, and me, Malika Bilal. Our sound designer is Alex Roldan. Our engagement producer is Natalia Aldana. Our executive producer is Stacey Samuel. And our head of audio is Graylin Brashear. And a special thanks to our Miami-based producer, Kareem Haddad, and correspondent Andy Gallagher. On Wednesday, we revisit Sudan, 1 year after a deadly massacre that brought a new government to a country that had been ruled as a dictatorship for years. We'll be back.
wheeling and dealing with the people. My soul is tired, white folks, of what you have done to us. If this society of yours is a great society, God knows I would hate to live in a bad one.
We are sick and tired of being sick and tired. And we are tired of people saying that we are satisfied, because we are everything but satisfied.
Who is that woman? Is she speaking 50 years ago or today? I'm Anita Johnson, and that's the voice of civil rights leader Fannie Lou Hamer.
Keep your land trimmed and a-burning. Keep your land trimmed and a-burning.
Mrs. Hamer would have turned 100 years old on October 6, 2017. Today on Making Contact, you'll hear archival recordings and excerpts from a powerful new documentary featuring Fannie Lou Hamer's contemporaries, themselves now elders. But first, you'll hear about the context of her life and the lives of other sharecroppers in Mississippi 60 years ago. Dream Deferred was an outreach film made in 1964 by Harvey Richards, together with members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. SNCC's Amzie Moore introduces the sharecroppers and their situation.
I wonder about 150,000 people in the 18 Delta counties. I just keep wondering how they're going to eat and what they're going to wear, because they have no money, they have no food, and they have no clothing. They have no way to buy food and clothing. There's no work on the farm for them to do, because the mechanical cotton picker has taken the job of picking cotton, and we have what is called the pre-merge, which is killing the weeds, and they can't do much chopping.
We are farming people here in Mississippi, and we rent land, and at the end of the year, most of our earnings go to pay rent, and the different expenses of the crops takes all that we make. And when we pay for what we avoid to make a crop, we hardly have enough money left to do us through the winter. We usually have to go back and make arrangements for to live on the contents of. The farming proposition has got so high here, we have to use so much fertilizer, so much poison, and whatnot, until after it's all said and done, the white man gets the biggest of the money, and we don't have any left. We are just poor people and need food and clothing for our kids.
To understand relations between black and white in Mississippi, one must understand the central role of violence. Violence in many forms. Aimless violence by a white citizen who beats a Negro for a lark. Purposeful violence by a gang of whites who drive by the home of a sharecropper who seeks to vote and fire a dozen shots into his living room. One must understand that violence from whites, both police and private citizens, against blacks is part of the Southern way of life. Finally, one must understand that violence against the Negro, from whatever source, receives no legal redress, not from the patrolman or the deputy sheriff, not from the local prosecutor or the judge.
To my idea, a Negro in the state of Mississippi, not only in Tallahatchie County, in the state of Mississippi, he don't stand a chance of a rabbit. You have to buy a license to kill rabbits. You don't have to buy anything to kill Negroes. We don't have no rights at all in Mississippi. We can't even have a white man arrested for doing anything. If he, a Negro, happens to steal a chicken or something from him, he'll get 10 to 20 years or probably a lifetime on penitentiary. He could kill your mother or your baby, anything. He don't get no time at all. And they'll even get punished for it. You can't even have a rest and can't even talk to the shame.
Down in suffering, suffering so long, even though it's under all of ground, sunrise now, it's fighting for my freedom and I want it now.
Fannie Lou Hamer's roots were in the community described in Harvey Richards' SNCC film. She began picking cotton at the age of six and lived as a sharecropper and a timekeeper on a plantation in Sunflower County. She was deeply religious. Her adoptive daughter believes she became woke in her activism after she discovered she had been sterilized without her consent by a white doctor. So when the SNCC voter registration drives began, she joined in. And she always said, the only way they'll get me out of the movement is to kill me.
We want leaders in our community. And what people will say, well, if we can get rid of Fannie Lou, say we can get rid of the trouble. But what they don't know, freedom is like an Eden Council. If you kill me, it'll break out all over the place.
In a soon-to-be-released film by Robin Hamilton entitled This Little Light of Mine, The Legacy of Fannie Lou Hamer, we hear from civil rights activists Dori Ladner and Heather Booth, former members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and Reverend Leslie McLemore, who worked with Mrs. Hamer in the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, he recalls.
The linchpin of the changes in the rules of the Democratic National Convention reside in the testimony of Mrs. Hamer.
Well, Mrs. Hamer's position was that if we don't have the right to vote, we can't talk, because she realized that the power was in the political process, in the vote. I met Mrs. Hamer in a mass meeting, and shortly after then, we went to the courthouse to register to vote. We took a whole busload of people on a yellow school bus to the Indianola courthouse to register to vote, and stayed there all day long. And you at their mercy, the police are standing outside the door with the billy clubs, you know, the sheriffs and so forth. So you're intimidating situation to begin with when you get the nerve to go into the courthouse.
So you couldn't register in the normal system, let alone the poll taxes and the literacy tests that were totally rigged to allow white people to be able to register and to prevent black people from registering. You know, asking questions like, how many bubbles in a bar of Ivory soap? Or what does Section 309 mean in the Mississippi Constitution without looking at a copy of the Constitution there? Whereas white people might simply be asked, what's your name and where do you live?
It was within this context that on August 31st of 1962, Mrs. Hamer took the test and tried to register to vote. She got on the bus and headed home to her bare-bones shack next to the fields, where she was soon confronted by the plantation owner, Mr. Marlowe.
He said, well, Fannie Lou said, you will have to go down and withdraw or you will have to leave. And I addressed and told him, as we have always had to say, Mister, I said, I didn't register for you. I said, I was trying to register for myself. He said, we're not ready for that in Mississippi. He wasn't ready, but I've been ready a long time. I had to leave that same night. On the 10th of September in 1962, 16 bullets was fired into the home of Mr. and Mrs. Robert Tucker for me. Now, the question I raise, is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where people are being murdered, lynched, and killed because we want to register and vote?
I first met Mrs. Hamer in the winter of 1963, after she had been evicted from the Marlowe plantation. We got to know each other, you know, through the workshops, because they were all day and singing at night after dinner. And Fannie Lou Hamer just emerged as the person on the spot. I mean, with the singing, with the talking, with the role playing, and just her presence.
Overpowered because her voice, she had this magnetic voice that she threw her head back and started singing.
Music was such an important part of the movement, and the music really set the stage for a lot of the mass meetings because there was always singing before the mass meeting. I mean, the really good mass meeting.
That's the voice of Fannie Lou Hamer in 1964, with echoes for today. And you're listening to Making Contact. To hear this entire program, or others, check out our website at radioproject.org. Subscribe to our podcast. Sign up for Making Contact updates. Take our survey, or join the conversation on Facebook or Twitter. Fannie Lou Hamer soon emerged as a leader. She felt that the only way thousands of Black people in Mississippi were going to be able to vote was to register. And the only way to register was with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. So she fought for that party to be recognized as part of the Mississippi delegation to the Democratic National Convention.
So we started to register people for the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And Ms. Hamer and Reverend King were the two co-chairs of that party. And our goal then was to get representation of the integrated delegation at the Democratic Convention, which was being held in Atlantic City.
We are recognized as the party.
But we worked out in advance what Martin would say, what I was going to say as a white Mississippian, was violence that had been directed to me and to others and described the violence. And that got too much for the white delegation. And they tried to shut me up.
I have been imprisoned. I have been beaten. I have been close to death.
That was a mistake on their part because they knew they couldn't shut up Martin Luther King, but they weren't paying any attention to who this woman might be. And I knew she was going to be more than Martin. We weren't even sure it was going to be broadcast. We prepared it. So she wasn't trying to be a media star to the nation. We really thought they won't carry it at all. Lyndon Johnson wanted it stopped and wanted other messages.
Yes, that was controversial. Lyndon Johnson reportedly said, get that woman off of TV. Don't have her back on television again.
But because of the hostility towards her, the media presented more of what she had to say.
This is on account of we want to register to become first-class citizens. And if the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America.
She brought to the fore the Freedom Democratic Party, what it meant, what it stood for, and the people. So she shined a certain light on the people in the room. But what she did, she brought special attention to all of us who were delegates, all of us who were from Mississippi.
At the convention, Humphrey was explaining to us that Johnson had said he could become vice president if the convention didn't blow up, and that we had to be stopped. So Humphrey is begging, and he knew she was the one he had to convince, not me. And then he said, you folks have got to help me. I must have this job. And she said, Senator Humphrey, I worked on Mr. Marlowe's plantation in Sunflower County, home of Senator Eastland. And when I tried to register to vote, I lost my job. And Pat, my husband, they fired him just because of me, and then they made us move out of the house. She then moved in with some local people, and they shot into the homes where she was staying. And then she said, Senator Humphrey, I'm here, though. God's taking care of me. Senator Humphrey, don't worry. If you lose this job of vice president, God's going to take care of you. That ended the conversation, and she was excluded from the final negotiations.
Fannie Lou Hamer testified at the pre-convention about an incident she recounted many times. June 9, 1963, Fannie Lou Hamer had gone to a voter education workshop in South Carolina. When she entered back into the state of Mississippi, her group's bus pulled into a rest stop. There they were ambushed by the police. Six of them were taken to the Winona jail.
And I was put in a cell with Miss Yvester Simpson. And after I was put in this cell, I could just hear some horrible screams and horrible sounds, you know, of licks. And I saw one of the girls was 15 years old, was with us. When she passed my cell, and she was real bloody. And then they asked the little man that cleaned up the jail to go inside and mop up that blood. And then I heard some more screaming, and I heard some awful sounds. And I would hear somebody when they say, "Can't you say yes, sir, nigger? Can't you say yes, sir?" And they would call her names that I wouldn't want to go on tape. And she said, "Yes, I can say yes, sir." So I said, and she said, "I don't know you well enough." And I would hear when she would hit the floor again. And finally, she began to pray. And she asked God to have mercy on these people because they didn't know what they was doing. And after a while, they passed my cell door with this young woman, Miss Annelle Ponder. And one of her eyes looked like blood, and her hair was standing up on her head, and her clothes had been torn from the shoulder down to the waist. And then three white men came to my cell, and one of them was a state highway patrolman because he was wearing a little silver plate across his pocket that said John L. Bassinger. And he asked me where I was from, and I told him I was from Louisville, and he said, "I'm gonna check that." And he went out, and I guess he called Louisville. And they didn't like me in Louisville because I worked with voter registration there. And when he came back, he said, "You damn right." He said, "You're from Louisville, all right. And we gonna make you wish you was dead." And they led me out of that cell into another cell. And he gave a Negro prisoner a blackjack. And he ordered me to lay down on a bunk bed. And a Negro prisoner said, "Do you want me to beat her with this, sir?" And he said, "You're damn right, because if you don't, you know what I'll do for you." And I laid down on the bunk like he ordered me to do. And the first Negro beat me. He beat me until he was exhausted. And after he beat, the state highway patrolman ordered the second Negro to take the blackjack. And during the time he was beating, I began to work my feet because that was a horrible experience. And the state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro that had beat to sit on my feet while the second one beat. And I just began to scream where I couldn't control it. And then the white man got up and began to beat me in my head. I have a blood clot now in the artery to the left eye and a permanent kidney injury on the right side from that beating. These are the things that we go through in the state of Mississippi, just trying to be treated like a human being. But still, this is called a part of America.
Shared her experience of being jailed and beaten. She became known around the world, although today's history books may not reflect that. She was in dialogue with many facets of the Black struggle, including her friend Malcolm X and groups defending their communities with arms, such as the Deacons for Defense.
I respect those people because they are doing what I believe every Negro under the heaven feel if he doesn't have the guts to say it. People have different feelings about Dr. King. But Dr. King's organization do have some great people like Mrs. Septima P. Clark that wrote the book Echoes in My Soul is a great woman, and there's quite a few other people that I admire in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and respect. But I take this stand with any person. A person that was born in the middle class that have never had to suffer. You know, he can afford to take things maybe easier than I can, and all I've ever done was suffered, you see. In fact, a person that's born in the middle class and have always had things somewhat decent, he can't make a decision for me because he actually don't know how I feel. I don't see all people as bad. If we didn't have some good white people, it wouldn't be anybody standing up, you know, trying to help bring about a change and make things better, not only for the Negro, but it will benefit every human being in this country if we were just freed.
Fannie Lou Hamer spoke out on civil rights, women's rights, human rights, and anti-poverty. In 1969, Claude Marks of the Freedom Archives recorded Ms. Hamer discussing the racism of the U.S. war in Vietnam and the displacement of people of color in what was then termed urban renewal.
Because people now no longer believe in a lot of the stuff they've been reading. You know, I was really shocked. I got to go into a little of our history to come back to Vietnam and our policies. The truth hadn't been told to us, no way. Because I was really shocked when I found out that Columbus didn't discover America. When he got hit with some black brothers saying, get on off, honey, and tell us where you want to go. You kept too many things hid, not only from my kids, but you kept them from your kids. That's the reason why your own kids is rebelling against you because of a sick system. But we want the boys, you know, I don't think that we have time to say, well, we can get them out after another million is killed. We want the fellas to come home now. And, you know, I do believe with this kind of audience, and I think it's this kind of audience in other places, I think a man should be impeached when they are not really dealing with the people. And I want to say to you, white America, you can't destroy me because I'm black to save your life without destroying yourself. All right, well, we want to have peace. We want to have peace, and the only way that we can have peace is to bring the boys home from Vietnam, start dealing with the problems in the United States, stop all of this urban renewal and model cities that's pushing people out of a place to stay and start dealing with facts of life. Right on. It's a lot of people that said, well, forget about politics. But baby, what we eat is politics. And I'm not gonna forget no politics. Because in 1972, when I go to Washington as Senator Hamer from Mississippi, you gonna know it's gonna be some changes made. Because we are going to change Mississippi.
Let's give Fannie Lou Hamer the last word.
And we are on our way now. We are on our way, and we won't turn around. We don't have anything to fear. We have moaned a long time in Mississippi. And he said, the meek shall inherit the earth. And there's no race in America that's no meeker than a Negro. We are the only race in America that has had babies sold from our breasts, which was slavery time, and had mothers sold from their babies. And we are the only race in America that had one man to march through a mob crew just to go to school, which was James H. Mary. We don't have anything to be ashamed of. All we have to do is trust God and launch and out into the deep. You can pray until you faint, but if you don't get up and try to do something, God is not going to put it in your lap.
Fannie Lou Hamer. 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 Fannie Lou
Special thanks to Robin Hamilton and her new film, This Little Light of Mine, The Legacy of Fannie Lou Hamer. Paul Richards at Estuary Press for the use of the films Dream Deferred and Will Never Turn Back, produced by his late father, Harvey Richards. Claude Marks at the Freedom Archives. Colin Edwards and his widow, Mary Edwards. Paul Stewart at Hapcast Productions. Sean Dellis at Pacifica Archives, Keith McMillan at Jackson State University, Dr. Guha Shankar at the Library of Congress Folklife Center, Dr. Shade Turnipseed and her Cotton Pickers of America Monument and Interpretive Center. Emily Harris assisted with editing. And special thanks to our listener, Lisa E. Williams, for providing original music, and to the musicians appearing in Robin Hamilton's film, Matthew Prinz, Josh Kramer, Fred Capo, SendQ, Horty, ArtTune Tech, and Pond5 Music. The Making Contact team includes Lisa Rudman, Marie Che, RJ Lozada, Monica Lopez, Sabine Blazin, Vera Tyke Kolsker, and I'm Anita Johnson. Listen to us on iTunes or Stitcher and rate us so others can find Making Contact. Please share your feedback on Facebook or Twitter. Don't miss our news. You know, you can sign up for our updates at our website at radioproject.org. Again, thanks for listening.
Good afternoon. You're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing you a wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked to CKT 90.3 FM.
When she puts on a dress, you know she knocking them dead.